Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Gilcrease Museum opens a new exhibit this weekend devoted to early 20th century plein air art on the West Coast. California Impressionism, selections from the Irvine Museum, features 50 works by a variety of male and female artists working along the California coastline, through the foothills of Southern California, along the Sierra Nevada, as well as the southwestern deserts. The curator for the exhibition is the founding and current director of the Irvine Museum, Jean Stern, who was instrumental in reviving the reputation of this school of art, which was enormously popular during the first decades of the 20th century, but derisively known as eucalyptus art during modernism and abstract art's heyday. Stern was first a collector, then a gallery owner, and later a curator of art before becoming the founding director of the Irvine Museum in Southern California. The exhibit features works by well-known artists like Granville Redmond, Guy Rose, Franz Bischoff, Edgar Payne, and William Wendt, along with a host of lesser-known but equally talented artists. The exhibit opens this Sunday and continues on display through September 6th. The name of the exhibit, California Impressionism, selections from the Irvine Museum. Jean Stern joins us from the Irvine Museum by phone. Jean Stern, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Rich.
In addition to curating this show, you've been a leading figure in the revival of interest in California Impressionism or California plein air painting. And this type of painting was very popular for 30 years, 40 years or more, then more or less was dismissed for a generation or more. Why was that?
Well, I think it has to do with the vagaries of style and the popularity of certain artistic movements. The California Impressionist period comes right at the tail end of this fascination with realism and with Impressionism, and it actually overlaps into some of the early modern movements that were happening in France and in New York. And I think it just kind of got pushed to the side in favor of more interesting, modern, more something different. There's always an attraction to the new and to the different, and I think that was one of the reasons why got pushed aside. Also, there's a generational change going on. Right about 1930, a lot of our best artists are either retired or dead, and their students come to the forefront, and like most art students, they want to do something different than what they were taught. So they turned to what was becoming popular and got interested in that.
I'm sure you're familiar with the term the eucalyptus school, which was how it was dismissed for a number of years, but really, your work prior to becoming director of the Irvine Museum as curator and gallery owner really helped change the view of California Impressionism. And you've been working on this for 30, 40 years now. What initially interests you in this art, given the fact that probably at the time you were developing your interest in it, it was terribly out of fashion?
Well, one of the things that interested me most of all is that there were a lot of beautiful work that had been painted 50 years prior and had been completely ignored. And my wife and I, I was a graduate student at the time in art history, we would go looking around for this, and we were able to find some beautiful paintings in antique store and Goodwill stores and places that, you know, were not specialist art galleries. And they were very inexpensive, and with our very limited budget at the time, we decided to buy what we could of it. So we started collecting these paintings, and at the time, there was no information available. There were no books. And all we knew is that they were California, and they were beautiful, and they were inexpensive. and that's how I got started.
What was the reaction when you began promoting California Impressionism as a gallerist and a curator? Was there a lot of resistance?
No, there wasn't really, because the material was beautiful. That was the case. And also, as a dealer, when I became an art dealer starting in 1978, we were able to procure a large number of these, primarily from estates or family members. And we were able to, you know, prepare them, clean them, and frame them, photograph them, write some history about them. And we were able to offer them at a very reasonable price, and people took to it very quickly. I think the secret of any art style is that if people see it, they'll like it. That's the goal, of course. You want people to like what it is, And once they like it, they'll want to have it around.
And it is gorgeous art. I mean, that's first and foremost, just as the Impressionists were enchanted by the light of the Riviera or the light along the River Seine in France, these artists were enchanted by the light in California and the beauty of nature, where you had, you know, mountains an hour away from the ocean.
Well, you're exactly right. In Europe, Impressionism was an urban experience, but it was a plein air or outdoor. Artists decided to get out of the studio to paint the natural light and to be in that light while they're painting, and that caught on. And American artists who were studying in Europe at the time, this is in the 1870s and early 1880s, really took to it and brought it back at first to the East Coast and then to California. But this idea of painting outdoors caught on very well because it had to do with light, it had to do with nature, it had to do with something that had a very strong healing quality to the human spirit. Essentially, if you can't be outdoors, have paintings of the outdoors around you.
Now, one of the things this exhibit does, there are certain names that have sort of transcended this movement to become pretty well known. Edgar Payne is one known to our audience, mainly because of his, what we call his Western art, the great images of the Canyon de Chaix in Arizona. But Edgar Payne was working on the coast, working in Pasadena and all these places at a time when there weren't millions and millions of people, and you're seeing the natural landscape that originally drew people to places like Southern California or Northern California, for that matter.
Yeah, it's not unusual at all, Rich, to see paintings that show what this area looked like before the massive population explosion of after World War II. And Edgar Payne, well, you had that fantastic show there in Tulsa, the Gilcrease, a couple of years ago, which I know drew large audiences because I was there and I did a tour of the exhibition. But he's very popular. He's primarily noted for his paintings of the Sierra Nevada mountains. But as you said, he also painted in the mesas and deserts of the Southwest and is a very popular artist, has a national reputation, something which he did not have 30, 40 years ago. He was hardly known at all at the time that I started getting interested in this material.
Well, tell us a little bit about the overall view of California Impressionism, the exhibit. A lot of different artists, and some that would know, there is an Edgar Payne, there's several Franz Bischoffs, there's a Guy Rose, there's also a Granville Redman. These are probably the most recognizable names of California Impressionism.
Well, it's actually a bit of a deception, Rich, because the show is titled California Impressionism, but we have some paintings that are not Impressionists in there. We have a wonderful painting by Jesse Arms Botke. This is a woman who is very much an Art Deco painter, uses gold leaf and lots of detail and paints elegant designs, which was completely contrary to the Impressionist approach. And we also have some modernist pieces in there. We have a wonderful painting by Eleanor Colburn called Bathing Baby, which is a very strong modernist painting, although painted in 1930 at the tail end of the California Impressionist movement. It shows some very, very strong modernist tendencies. We wanted to document the material prior to the Impressionist period and the material that follows into the modernist period to kind of get the complete picture.
You know, that Colburn, though, at the same time, you're right, it does have a lot of modernist tendencies, but the subject matter is right out of Mary Cassatt.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, but she was a painter who was very much into an approach called dynamic symmetry, which uses geometry and lines, and if you look closely at the painting, you'll see that every form is connected to a line that connects to something else on the opposite side of the painting. It's a very difficult way to paint, and Maynard Dixon was very much an aficionado of dynamic symmetry, and he did that a lot. But generally, painters were kind of wary of it because it took so long to get it done.
Yeah. Another one that shows a lot of modernist tendencies is Philip Dyke's Corona del Mar, or Newport Harbor.
Yes.
And that's 1932, and it has a very distinct modernist. You can see the modernist influences beginning to enter this. But again, it's a subject matter that is right out of the California Impressionist school, this natural view of an open bay.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Boats.
It is everyday life. It is what you see around you. It is not some glorious message about any kind of ethic or religion or anything like that. It is just what you see. And this is what these artists were fascinated by everyday life.
Yeah. One of the things I found really interesting was the mix of men and female artists. There are a lot of female artists in this movement.
There are. It is very unusual because certainly on the East Coast, it was mostly a male establishment. But as you get farther west, more and more female artists become important painters in these organizations because they were there at the beginning. They were founders of some of these organizations. And in California, it's very much a very equal opportunity type of art scene.
Alison Skinner Clark, we mentioned Eleanor Colburn, several of them. Another one, which I just came across in the last few years, Henrietta Shore. Now, the work I've seen of hers is almost like a mirror of what George O'Keefe was doing. In fact, they were contemporaries for a few years in the Southwest. And they have these, you know, these wonderful, what we refer to as O'Keefean sort of looks at the Southwest, yet she was doing it the exact same time as O'Keefe, and who knows who was influencing who. But in the show, there's actually an earlier piece from her California time, which I guess she spent a lot of time in California.
Well, that's a very astute observation because there are these connections, and these people were contemporaries of each other. And as you said, who knows influenced who? I think O'Keefe was such a famous artist, but it's very likely that she was the dominant influence because her name was known throughout the country. But there are some wonderful examples of all these different minor isms that pop up in California.
Well, and the piece you have in the show by her is it's this very stylized looking piece called Mount Wilson, which you can see where this O'Keefean influence is going to be in about 20 or 30 years. This is, I think, from maybe the late teens, maybe early teens, middle teens. And it's a very stylized looking image. It was very different from what I expect to see from California Impressionism. Though.
No, it clearly is an Impressionism, as you point out. It's really much of an art moderne. There's streamlined forms. There's elegant designs. It isn't the choppy brushstroke and bright colors of Monet. But it shows the evolution, and it shows that even though these California artists, men and women, were on the far edge of the art world at the time, they were open to these things. They were aware, and they experimented with them.
Now, that's another interesting point. About half of these artists, maybe a little more, did go to Europe. They did learn, they were seeing Impressionism and Post-Impressionism and came back to this country. But quite a few of them, we have to remember that this whole painting community was, you know, at the time when you took a railroad and it took 4 days to get across the country. And so they were somewhat isolated.
Yeah, they were. And we didn't have, you know, technology. You couldn't just get on the tube and see what's going on in Switzerland. But they traveled. They, as you said, many of them, if not most of them, studied in Europe. They studied in New York and Chicago. And it pretty much chose to get away from it all, to come to a place of opportunity, for one thing, and to explore their own artistic tendencies. In this period of art, it's a very interesting period, Rich, on many, many accounts, but of the artists in exhibition, only one is actually born in California in the early period, and that's Guy Rose. The rest of them came from somewhere else, sometimes from other countries, but they all died in California. So it tells you a lot that they found California the place where they wanted to live, where they wanted to work, and where they wanted to continue their lives.
Guy Rose is one of those artists that really has been highly collectible for a number of years, and there's a really gorgeous image in the show, and it's of a eucalyptus grove.
Yeah, it's a tall, elegant strand of eucalyptus trees.
And the way he would draw these trees is they're just so beautiful.
Well, he's a unique artist in that he was a California boy, and then he studied in France and lived in Giverny and became a friend of Claude Monet. Although they did not paint together, Monet never painted with anybody once he escaped to Giverny. But Rose returned to the U.S. and returned to California and is in fact probably the only pure Impressionist painter of the group in terms of the original definition set by the French.
Now let's talk about some of the earliest artists here in the show. William Wendt would be one. There's several images by Wendt, and Wendt is this, he's just this prototypical impressionist. There's just the sumptuous colors, you know, in the spring there's gorgeous greens, in the fall there's these just luscious tans and ochres and browns. Beautiful, beautiful work.
Yes, he's perhaps the most influential of the California painters. He lived in Laguna Beach most of his life, and he was often termed the dean of the California painters. A quiet man of German origin, but painted usually by himself. He rarely painted small paintings outdoors. He painted the entire painting outdoor. He was one of these pure plein air painters where he would set up a rather large canvas and paint directly outside.
Now, you said he painted alone. Within the Impressionist school in France, oftentimes artists gathered together. They would do plein air paintings together. There's famous images along the Seine of literally Renoir and Monet setting their easels next to each other.
Exactly, side by side.
Side by side, and you get these wonderful juxtapositions of the same image through two sets of eyes. Was that similar for the Impressionists, or were they tend to be more solitary?
No, California, one of the oldest art clubs in the country is the California Art Club, founded in 1909. There were a lot of artists that loved to paint in groups, but there are a few that are solitary, that would rather be by themselves. They tend to be the quiet ones. They tend to be the ones that don't, you know, congregate, although they did exhibit together and they did appear together and they knew each other. Wendt was a bit of a loner. But these other artists, they thought nothing of getting together and having a paint out together, going to the coast together, to the mountains together. No, artists like to paint with each other. They enjoy the contact.
My guest today is Jean Stern, the director of the Irvine Museum and the founding director of that museum. Gilcrease is presenting California Impressionism, selections from the Irvine Museum. It'll be on display this Sunday through September 6th. About 50 works of California Impressionism, a little bit of early modernism, but really based on the principle. I think the whole show is based, for the most part, on this idea of plein air painting. And this group of artists influenced by American Impressionism, but probably French Impressionism, and painting what they saw in Southern California. And I think that's one of we were talking earlier about one of the great joys of this show is you see places like, there's a picture in the show of Hollywood at a time when there is no Hollywood. It's mountains and rolling hills.
Well, it's exactly that. California was a slow-growing state until, one, the advent of the railroads in the mid-1880s, but even still, the real boom was right after World War II. And then we got this huge population. So these paintings show beautiful open country, which are now freeways and shopping centers and apartment houses. So it's an interesting historical lesson.
I would imagine at the Irvine Museum itself, there are a lot of people who comment on the fact that they're looking at, you know, there's where my house is.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We often have groups of senior citizens comes, and they'll tell us where these places are. And you look at them, you say, you know, you're right. That is where that is. They remember them from way, way back.
Let's talk about some of the other early painters in the show. One is Frederick Melville Dumont. A beautiful picture of Laguna Beach from 1911. This is, and it's again a prototypical impressionist view.
Yeah, that's when you should have bought that lot by the seashore for probably $300. But that was painted in 1911. Dumont was an Eastern painter. He and his brother, Frank Dumont, were very important painters in the East. And he came out to California very briefly. But he did this gorgeous view of what is now one of the most expensive pieces of real estate in California.
Another name that is really associated with California Impressionism is Franz Bischoff. Tell us a little bit about Bischoff.
Well, Bischoff was an Austrian-born artist. He was born in Bohemia, which is now part of the Czech Republic, and he was trained as a China painter, and he did these gorgeous porcelains. In fact, he's the number one American China painter. He's kind of the Rembrandt of China painting in the United States. His porcelains are very collectible and they're very highly desirable. But he came to California in 1906 and began painting landscapes. and suddenly he's a landscape painter, and he applies his knowledge of technique and of color, particularly color, and creates these really wonderful harmonies of color as he looks at the landscapes. He's primarily known as a still life painter, but he's also a fantastic landscape painter.
Yeah. And speaking of fantastic landscape painters, there is one piece, and I know that Irvine has many others, by Granville Redmond. And Redmond is, when you think of California Impressionism, you think of sea views. He did those. He did some beautiful nighttime nocturnes along the ocean as well, but also for those inland wildflower blooms.
Yes, that's exactly right.
You know, just these yeah. gorgeous.
Poppies and lupins.
Yeah.
The two typical flowers of California. Of course, the poppy, the golden poppy, is the state flower. But Redmond grew up, he was born in Philadelphia and lost his hearing when he was about two because of scarlet fever, and he never spoke after that and never heard anything. So he was essentially deaf-mute, so he learned to communicate by writing notes or by sign language, and one of the classes he took in the deaf school was pantomime, and he learned to express himself very, very well with his gestures. That's a necessity for somebody who doesn't speak. So he came to Los Angeles in 1917 as a young man to audition for the movies. And the movies were silent at the time, so he was perfect.
Of course.
And he met Charlie Chaplin, became very good friends with him, and appears in six of his movies.
Now, when did he turn to painting? Was he a painter all along?
Yes, he was a painter all along. He studied art at the deaf school in Berkeley, studied with some great artists that were deaf, and began painting essentially dark, very introspective pieces, like the one that's in the show, the California Oaks. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he began to paint the brighter paintings. But his preference, and he states so in several notes, is that he'd much rather paint the dark, introspective pieces than the bright, happy pieces.
Well, what would you advise visitors coming to the gallery to see this show, what we should be looking for, looking at, in looking at these painters' techniques?
Well, you know, these paintings are what we call viewer-friendly. You don't need to know anything. You just come in and you enjoy it. You don't need to know anything about the artist. You don't need to know anything about any kind of ism or modern theory or what the artist is trying to do. These are paintings of nature. They're paintings of everyday life, and you will enjoy them because they will reach you on a level that's rather deep and that's universal to the human experience, and that is the contact with nature. So I advise them to come early and to enjoy it and to look around and to pick out their favorite and to have a good time.
Well, we wish you great success with the Irvine Museum, and I hope a lot of people come out to see this exhibit. It's on display throughout the summer at Gilcrease Museum, opening this Sunday, California Impressionism. Sean Stern, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Sean Stern is the director of the Irvine Museum in California. He's the founding director there and a leading figure in California Impressionism painting. He's also the curator for Gilcrease Museum's new traveling exhibition, California Impressionism, Selections from the Irvine Museum, which will be on display this Sunday through September 6th. Information at utulsa.gilcrease.edu. By the way, this might be a great weekend to make it a weekend of American art. This is also the last weekend to see Philbrook's exhibit of American Modernism from the Vilcek Foundation from New York to New Mexico closes on Sunday. Thank you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Janet Pearson.
Who among us doesn't have an unforgettable memory, or at least a really pleasant one, of a time spent in a public park? Maybe you remember a special outing at a little neighborhood park, or maybe it was in some place as glorious and grand as Yellowstone. Maybe the occasion was a family reunion, or a romantic interlude, or an unusual learning experience. I have a vivid memory of an experience I had at a little neighborhood park near my childhood home. It was there I learned how to make a lanyard. It took some effort, but looking back, I think I can say without fear of contradiction that mine was one of the finest lanyards ever produced at that park. Memorable though that experience was, it was only one of many memories that were in store for me. It was at a state park I learned to water ski, which would become a favorite summertime pastime. At a lonely lighthouse on the Oregon coast, I learned of the struggles and tragedies that were regular occurrences during our country's early history. At Yellowstone, I learned what literally lies beneath our feet as we traverse our planet. There's no question parks are popular, but sadly, they aren't winning any popularity contests when it comes to funding. Parks usually are among the first government services to fall victim to budget cuts when times are tough. The reasoning is simple enough. Most people just don't think parks are as important as, say, health care or public safety. Maybe it's because I'm a hardcore outdoor nut, but I think parks ought to be a permanently high priority. But I'm not sure that will ever happen. The National Park Service, which will observe the centennial of its founding next year, has launched a publicity campaign aimed at helping to address an $11 billion backlog of unfunded needs, a problem that has grown worse over the years. It used to be that scare tactics like threatening to close down the Washington Monument or Yosemite would have the desired effect. But these days, it seems young people would rather stay indoors glued to electronic gizmos than spend a few magical hours in a place like a park. So it's likely the maintenance needs will only keep growing. That's too bad. I can't imagine growing up without parks, just as I can't imagine life without all the experiences and epiphanies and memories that can only be had in a place like a park. Such sensations are perfectly captured in the poem, The Peace of Wild Things, by writer and naturalist Wendell Berry. I'll close with a few lines. When despair for the world grows in me, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
Janet Pearson is a former op-ed writer for the Tulsa World and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.